are listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only Jeremy Davis. Jeremy!
Hey, Mike, what's up?
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, I'm checking out Jeremy's new toy.
And across from Jeremy, across the table, we've got the one and only, the Iron Man of the Audio Nowcasts, Mr. This is show 117 in a row, Rob Arbiter.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Mike.
So you got to come with the older voice now.
You know? Well, after 117 shows, I don't think I have to turn it on. I think after 117 shows,
you're ready for your own radio show. Yeah.
It's built in.
And today, joining us for show
117,
we have the honor and the privilege of having Mr. Joe Ciccarelli with us.
Joe!
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, here's a couple of funny thoughts about Joe Ciccarelli. He was actually going to be one of our first guests.
I was supposed to be on show one.
Wow. He was one of our very first. If you go back, and I don't know what show it is, but I do a show where I say, I don't really know what we're going to be doing because the guests had to cancel. That was Joe.
Sounds like we had to get you better driving directions.
No, but you've been driving for 6 years.
I found it finally.
He was in a session, and you know how that goes. You're working and things go late. I totally understand. And so he finally made it. But what was really cool though is I've seen Joe at every trade show since.
And he's guilted.
He wore you down.
And you know what? I just meet him by saying, you don't have to apologize. It's okay. It'll happen. No, don't worry about it.
I see him across the room and it's just, I'm sorry.
Yeah, because, you know, after a while, I don't want to be that guy.
Will we call the audio then cast?
That's right. So this is 6 years in the waiting, Joe Ciccarelli.
All right.
So
don't disappoint us, Joe. No pressure.
I gotta bring the A stuff.
Absolutely. Bring the A game.
We want secrets. We want all kinds of stuff, but we'll get into that. Couple things I want to start off with before we start visiting with Joe a little bit. I just installed Pro Tools 10 at the place where I mix post-production. Mm-hmm. Literally did it today. And I have to admit, there was a small little things here or there, but it was probably one of the easiest upgrades I've done yet. I mean, everything worked. Machine control, all the esoteric little plugins. I even got EQ2. EQ2. I got that to work on Pro Tools 10.
Nice. Well, and the truth is, that's no small feat because Pro Tools 10, in a lot of ways, it may look similar, but there's a massive amount of difference under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that that transition is easy really says something.
And this is replacing a TDM system. I already work on my laptop in my home studio. I have Pro Tools 10, but this is with the new cards and everything. And it sounds really good.
HDX or, yep, or native?
No, HDX. Ooh. With the cards.
How many cards?
One card. Do you need more than one card?
Well, some do.
Well, actually.
I know. Scott does. Scott has sessions of like 700 tracks and things like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
What's your record?
Of the number of Pro Tools systems?
A number of tracks, yeah, Pro Tools systems. Rolf's.
Well, the most I've ever had was 12.
12 slaved?
Yes.
Wow.
But that's, I mean, but it,
well, there's not something on every track all the time.
Yeah, exactly. You know what it is? It comes down to categories. And a lot of times when we're working really fast and the CG's going in and out quickly and we're on a dubbing stage, what I like to do is there's no time to grab three systems and bounce it down to one.
Right.
It goes off the system into the stage mix.
Right.
And a lot of times we're only dealing, I mean, the most we're dealing with lately is 64 outputs.
Wow.
But a lot of times we'll take elements where I'd say it's not unusual to have, you know, 100 plus tracks.
Wow.
You know, I mean, we could fill them up, but a lot of times it's elements. But as anything, we're dealing in a 5-1 point situation.
Okay.
So you take everything divided by 6.
Yep.
So that's really, I mean, also per element. So if I have, you know, a creature, and I've got, you know, 2 or 3 dozen elements that go into that creature, and that's just all that does, and that's coming out. You know, you start sucking up tracks, and you start using up voices
right
pretty quickly.
Yep.
with RTAS, and next thing you know,
so he'll be needing the HDX5 system.
I was going to say
10 trillion voices.
But you know, it's just with Pro Tools 10. Kicks it up at the 250.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, I had plenty of track counts, and I have nothing scientific to base this on, but it just seemed like my system wasn't working as hard. It just was chewing through the audio, even the video.
Had way fewer crashes. It does seem smoother overall, but I mean, for me, the big thing is that sonically, it's way better. Just instantly playing back stuff that was recorded in 9 through it. Everything sounded more open, punchy. In fact, it was odd because I had done a little internal bounce of some background vocals mm-hmm. with some plugins, just very basic digi plugins.
Right.
In 9, in the other studio, in Studio 1 over at Sunset Sound, where I work a lot, and bounce sounded fine. And I just... They had upgraded the system in one of the other rooms. So I went over there just for kicks, did the same internal bounce in 10. Sonically, it was like night and day.
From 9 to 10?
So, yeah.
Or from 8 to 10?
Basically, I had started a project in 9.
Right.
They had upgraded another rig to
9
10.
TDM or 9 native?
This is all TDM.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah, 9
sure,
TDM. Sure. And then another rig, 10 TDM. Yeah. Did the same internal bounce, same internal plugins, but obviously now they're 10 plugins.
Right.
And just, I don't know, the whole thing seemed to have more top end, more clarity, more life. Just in fact, to the point where I wanted to start backing off the top end. On.
Have you gone away from the TDM into the native?
No. Most of the commercial studios where I work are still all TDM.
So. Yeah. You know, it's wild as I went from... 9 TDM to 9 native.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's got floating point, when I was doing, we were submitting all our award stuff and we were submitting Gears of War. And I'd done that in May and Gears 3, and I heard it and I was working on another mix. And it was crazy how different it was.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, between TDM always had that digi sound, everything was kind of glassy and crystally and you could just hear the quantization and just all the things that they deal with, especially if you hit it hard. And in gaming, there's elevated levels. So you're hitting it way harder than you should.
Right.
And when I went to native and it's now floating point, all that's gone.
Hmm.
And it's night and day. I mean, much air and breathing room. Yeah, and
exactly.
It definitely, it sounds good. Like I do a lot of posts. I do a lot of spot mixing. So we're, 15, 30 seconds, little bites here or there. But it just has a little bit more air and it just sounds good. And the computer it's really, really quick. And I was amazed at how fast, machine control and pulling plugins from, systems that I didn't even install. I literally just pulled the EQ2 plugin out of the plugin folder and stick it in and boom, it showed up. So
in native 9, we did 48 5.1 altiverbs. And the system only did 10%.
Wow. That's crazy.
It was almost like, okay. And then I took my Gears mix, which I maxed out on an HD3.
Right.
It just to the limit where it was choking. Put it on a native HD. Mm. Added 2 ear cams, 16 L316s. I just started putting plugins in mass amounts of plugins. And I only got it up to 30-40%.
Wow.
And I just went, okay. It got me so far,
It's definitely powerful. They're doing some good stuff. So
the other thing, the new plugins, I forget what they're calling them, but the ones that are based on the Euphonics console.
The Shadow Strip?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds amazing.
It's very smooth. It kind of feels like, yes.
Very open, very invisible, but still has character and compressor does a thing. And I was pretty impressed.
It has a... It has a high-end sound to it.
It does.
For a built-in plugin, it really sounds like you would pay money to get that. It's like the first time you
heard...
It's
almost like a tube something. Mm-hmm. Even though, because I just finished doing a movie, actually. I learned the Euphonics Series 5. So I pre-dubbed it in my room, went to spent 2 weeks on the console itself, and so I learned the sound, the Euphonics sound. Then I actually upgraded to Pro Tools 10. And it's the same sound.
Wow, that's great.
And it's amazing. The channel strip, that's the Euphonics sound.
So, I'll keep everybody posted on how it goes. So, the next podcast, I'll maybe go and God, you're
fair, fair. I don't know, seriously, I've been on it a few weeks now, a month or two, actually, and it's been pretty flawless.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm hearing.
That's good. Yeah.
Pro Tools 9, I know, has been a little bit, you know, hit
not,
and miss.
Not as stable.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you don't have a, especially on the native side, if you have a quad core rather than a 8-core.
Right.
It's anyone's guess how it's going to go. But I found the 10s across the board we've been testing, it's just working.
The other thing you have to keep in mind is 10 changed the whole way the disk architecture worked. Yeah. So now, you know, your session, basically, if you have a computer with enough RAM, the whole your whole project can live in your RAM.
Right.
And that's huge because it means that you don't have to worry about the speed of whatever your medium is. So you can, work over a network. You could bring in a session off a thumb drive if you wanted, and you're fine. You can't overstate how unbelievably complicated of a change that was to take a system that's been mature and been out for a really long time and somehow rework the entire low-level disk engine to be able to play out of RAM like that. It's mind-boggling.
So you're playing off a Dropbox.
Pretty much. I mean, it's mind-boggling that that works and that it's as stable as it was. They baited their brains out on that because that's huge. That's way more complicated than some of the visual tricks that everybody would ooh and ah about.
Right. I'll keep everybody updated to see how it goes. But right off the bat, I think it's going really well. Before we end this segment on Pro Tools, how big are the rigs that you're working on, Joe?
You know, I still mix everything and track everything through an analog console. So I'm, breaking stuff out to 32 faders, 48 faders, depends. But the track count is probably, even for a rock band now, it's approaching 100 tracks. You know, because you can't do a song now where there is one drum kit through the whole song.
Right.
You know, the verse has to have a different tone than the chorus, and then the bridge has yet a third, and then there's a couple of loops mixed in. So you know, you're probably up to like 3-4 drum kits per song.
Do you re-record onto a second system?
No. I mean, occasionally, if I'm printing my mixes, I might get a second system just to print the mix to. But I'm just using one system.
Okay.
Yeah.
The amazing thing to me is, if you think about it, it's only a few years ago, the Beatles were able to make their records with only 90 tracks. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that 8 tracks? It's amazing. But you know what? The human spirit, you will always fill however many tracks you
absolutely,
have.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sure.
I swore I would never, in Pro Tools, me, when it first came out 10 plus years ago, I was like, this is a tape recorder. This is all it is. I never will use more than 24 tracks. That lasted about an hour.
That lasted until you realized you could have more.
I can treat these background vocals different than these background vocals.
We've had many conversations where I've had to convince Stevie that, the added track count doesn't just mean that you record your song and then fill up the rest of the tracks with percussion. the song doesn't need 75 shakers. But it's very tempting.
But it's amazing as our tools are getting better and we're getting more tracks and things like that, there seems to be this movement to kind of like going back to the basics. I mean, if you look at what happened, with the Foo Fighters and their album that they just did, and going back to 2-inch, and I was over at Swing House Studios interviewing Jack Douglas with the new Aerosmith, and they're using the Class system. We have all these great tools, and yet people are kind of longing for the good old days. Why do you think that is? What do you think they're looking for in that?
Personally, I think it's because now everybody can have the tools to record anything they can think of, basically. So everybody's sort of on a level playing field. It's not like you have to have $1 zillion to book some great studio to capture some ideas. I mean, some you still do, but the playing field's a lot more level, so it comes down to who actually has the best ideas and the best songs and the best arrangements.
What about you, Joe?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of things going on. I mean, personally, I think I've always been, kind of back to the basics kind of guy. I mean,
right.
I've always kind of when I grew up as an engineer, you committed to tape, you got your sounds, your compression, your effects, whatever it was, you did it when you recorded, and you made the record there. When you put up 24 faders or whatever it was, that was the record. It wasn't a whole guessing game that went on of deleting 40 tracks, and you made it as you went along. So it's not really anything, a return to anything for me. But I do think culturally there's a few things going on. I mean, I think that there's always a kind of opposite motion, that meaning that pop music has become so overly fabricated and so produced. And then you have DJ culture, which is so all about being cut up and manipulated, that, yeah, the pendulum is going to swing absolutely the opposite way. So you're going to have some cultural underground that's going to want to try to do the opposite, that's going to want to try to do something that's simpler, earthier, more honest. And then on top of it, you have a phenomenon like Adele, and I use the word phenomenon not to take anything away from her, but the sales, the explosion of it, and the cultural groundswell is quite a phenomenon. So you have something like that going on, where I think the average music fan perceives her as a real artist singing her real songs, her stories, honest emotional takes, and production that isn't overly blown up. If we all know how to make records and can dissect an Adele record and realize that it's not as simple as it appears to be.
Right.
But to the public, that's a very organic record. Mm-hmm. So I think there's this sort of momentum going on now where people feel like that's the thing to make, because indeed it is the absolute opposite of rap records, Katy Perry records, Uber produced pop records.
Isn't it kind of like, I remember when there was industrial rock? Mm-hmm. Rock got to the point where everything from Janis Joplin and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, where it wasn't perfect, and people were out of tune, and you heard the room, and it wasn't, but they captured it, to all the way to industrial rock, where everything was so tight, so cleared, so perfected. Then you hit Nirvana.
Right, exactly.
And then all of a sudden, that whole, grunge comes in and says, you know what, we're not perfect. We're going back.
I think you're right.
And then
on
it seems like we got to the point where now we've tweaked it so many times.
Right.
And I also think, I don't know, maybe it could be wrong, but it seems like the musicians want to be bands again, where instead of nobody showing up for the record, they all do it individually, that they want to just all sit down, play it together. Maybe we do the vocals because, but in other words, they still want to play as a band.
I think that's got a lot to do with it, certainly for players. I mean, I just finished spending a few months doing this Jason Mraz record, who's just really wonderful singer, songwriter, artist. And basically, I got five guys in a room. Jason sang live, some vocals, some live vocals kept, someone's not kept.
Right.
But man, the players, 6 months later, are all coming up to me saying, man, that's the best time I've had making records in 10 years.
Wow.
I love this record. This is my favorite thing I've worked on.
And that's the way it always used to be.
Exactly. The thing that we all grew up, and that most people still try to emulate, those Led Zeppelin records or whatever it is that you grew up on, it was about the chemistry that happened between those people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And about those, you mentioned Jack White earlier, and Jack is all about mistakes. I mean, all about leaving the flaws in, because it, number one, it sounds human. It kind of tricks your ear into believing there's people in the room creating it when you hear something that's just maybe pushing the time or I don't know, just some weird guitar noise or whatever it is, and just getting that performance where it feels like just magic and chemistry. And you listen to any of the great records that we're talking about, everything from Paul Simon to Led Zeppelin to whatever, and there's plenty of flaws on those records. Stevie Wonder, there's plenty of them. You hear him hitting the microphones with his drums. But man, there's such magic and honesty, and it's incredible.
I find myself listening to the radio. If you listen for any extended period of time now, you long to hear somebody sing out a tune.
Yep.
Everything is just so perfect and polished.
But you want the personality, and I think sometimes what happens is you get amazing players. And these guys can come in with or without anybody. They lay it down. It's dead right. It's accurate. It's punchy. It's grooved. But it may not be it may not have that humanity in it as much, that extra little.
But see, you know what? Does it not have the humanity, or it doesn't have a certain type of humanity? Because if you
wrong word for humanity. It's all human because it's done by humans.
Right. Hmm?
It may not have as much of a personality, I think, is a better.
Yeah, but even still.
Because when bands play, there's a certain.
Yeah, there's a risk.
I understand that, but what's so ironic about music today is that no matter what genre you're in, the tools that you have are just amazing. You can have amazing sounding heavy metal. You can have amazing sounding pop. I mean, it's gone to the point where you can just – I mean, you just have some really amazing stuff. I mean, we kind of all bash pop, but if you listen to some of the production on some of the pop records
– I can't make those records. I don't know how to do that.
It's phenomenal. Genius. I mean, I go to school on these things. I mean, listen to it. Not that I'll ever do that, but it's just amazing to hear what they're doing. And then also – I like electronic music. And so some of the stuff that's happening in the electronic realm is just – it's phenomenal.
Well, I think some music is more designed and some music is more just – I don't want to say the word organic because I think it's misused. But some of it's more grassroots. You know, some of it's just more somebody sitting down playing a guitar or just doing something.
Right.
And you hear that performance, you go, Mike, that's amazing. Electronic is not that.
No, that's
It's fine. But it, like you said, it's genre based.
It's I mean, it can be though, because you listen to some. I was listening to some stuff, and there was this bass groove that was hitting, and I was like, "Holy smokes!" I mean, it was a 7-minute long song because all the songs are that long. And guess what? I did 21 minutes of that song because it was so good, and it was so. You know, here's the thing though: some of the best electronic music has its roots in some of the what we would consider. Old, you know, classics like some funk or
absolutely.
You take a bass like Daft Punk and their bass riffs and some of the stuff that they do definitely are calling back to the funk. You know, they're calling back to
there's also dance. I mean, when I went to Moog Fest and I was lecturing there, we saw the bands and it was amazing how groove oriented and it was real. I mean, even Amon Coben doing his thing, it was really fun. I mean, it was. Yeah. It was all rhythm-based because that's all they really want to do is dance and with a bunch of amazing ear candy.
So I just want to encourage people that are listening that, you know, if you want to kind of capture some of this vibe that we're talking about that people are looking for, I think a good place to start is just start listening to some of the music from back then and trying to see what you can get and start picking apart some of these albums like the Adele album and listen to some Stevie Wonder stuff. And I mean, wouldn't you agree? I mean, Joe, how would you?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, back then, because the tools weren't there, it was all about the musicianship. And those guys came in and put the stuff down. You cut up a multi-track tape if you did that. You know, or you punched in a section. You didn't move time around. You didn't do any of that stuff till late 80s, you know. So all those great 70s, early 80s albums we're talking about are all about performance.
And you know what? I think any genre of music, the performance is the most important word. I think any genre of music, you can have a performance in it, even in electronica.
Absolutely.
I mean, like, at the Grammys, a lot of people got exposed to Deadmau5 for the first time.
Yeah.
Truth is, that stuff is brilliant, and there's a lot of performance aspects of it. It's not just a sequencer, you know, where you start it, go get coffee, and come back, and it's still doing the same thing. I mean, there can be performance in any genre, and that's really how you stand out. But I think we did go through sort of a dark time when it was okay to just – your song was a 4-bar loop, you know, forever. You know, thank you, Lynn 9000. You know, and I think we've come out of that some because once everybody gets used to that, then everybody wants more.
It also seems that certain devices like the Lynn and even Ableton and stuff, some things make life easy so people get used to it. And it might mean a little less musicianship. But then what happens is somebody gets creative with it.
Absolutely.
Somebody takes it with another, says, you know, I can do this with it. And it almost becomes instrument again. Mm-hmm. So instead of becoming a tool to do something, you know, everything from drum machines and how far they've progressed and they become new instruments that people do amazingly creative things on.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I wanted to talk about, as long as we're into this whole vibe of you know, going back to the basics is, Joe, you kind of mentioned this when we were talking about the pop records, and those aren't the kind of records that you work on, that you do. Let's talk about some of the records that you do. Especially like, I love Icky Thumb. That's like one of my favorite albums. And it's so, that would not be an album I would normally listen to, huh, because it's just, you know, I'm into, you know, electronics and synths. And, but I remember when I first heard it, I was just blown away by just the space, you know. It was just, it's simple, yet it's not simple. There's just, you know, even that on Icky Thumb itself, just that growl at the beginning of the song. Tell us a little bit about just the whole philosophy when you were recording that, when you were making that record.
Well, the funny thing was when Jack, I had worked with him previously, and when he talked to me about doing that record, he said, you know, I want to really step out this time. I want to take some chances. I really want to push myself and, you know, try something that's kind of modern but done with old school tools, you know. And I want to step it up and do this album 16 track. Okay. All the White Stripes albums were 8 track.
Really?
Track up to that point. And so 16 track was like, you know, one thing with him, and again, talk about performance, you know, he's not about indecision. He's about like, this feels great. This is it. Next. Mm-hmm. You know, and to have tracks around to experiment, he doesn't want to know about
that. He doesn't want to comp.
No, we can come time for vocals. Yeah. Vocals were he and I in the studio, and you know, he'd say, "What'd you think of that?" And I'll just go, "Hey, I think a lot of that was great. I don't know about the second verse, a couple of pitchy things in the bridge, but man, the first two choruses were awesome. You know, it was just amazing. All right, forget about it. Let's just erase it. I'll do it again. Really, you want me to save the choruses? No, just do it again. It's fine. I'll do it again." You know, I mean, he's just fearless like that.
Well, and he knows what he's capable of, which is an amazing thing.
And basically what he wanted from me is to either say, oh my God, that's the best thing you've ever sung, or anything below that bar, not interested. You know?
Yeah.
So the funny thing was, you know, him stretching out with the technology, and there was no tools, no Pro Tools whatsoever on that. And, you know, it was analog tape, good old Neve modules, API modules, a Trident 80B console. It was just two people in a room. And in fact, quite frankly, a number of times, two people in the room with no baffles, you know, and the loudest guitar. You could not walk when we had him in the ISO room. You couldn't walk in the ISO room when he was playing, even with shotgun ear protectors, because oh my there's gosh. Something about his attack, just the way he hits the guitar,
right,
that is so loud. It's like putting your head inside a cowbell. I mean, wow, it's just brutal.
So what did you use to mic it? What did you?
Well, we blew up 6 coals.
Oh, wow. Wait, were you at Blackbird when you did this?
Yes. So it was like, here's another one to be repaired.
What are you guys doing?
Was Vance there at the time?
Of course, yeah. Vance was chief engineer. That, you know, windscreens in front of the mic, it didn't matter. It's just, you know,
that much pressure.
Exactly. It just moves fast. That, you know, and I got to say, you know, there's all those people that diss Meg. And man, she was, first of all, she was just the sweetest person in the world to work with. But having worked with Jack with 3-4 different drummers now, there's no one that can do the White Stripes like she does. There's a certain freedom in her playing, a simplicity, and her ability to feel out his time and know when to pull back and when to speed up with him. And That's a performance. That's chemistry. Mm-hmm. Just a really special combination of people in it. I mean, that's the thing that I live for, making records. And I think that's what makes great bands, is that chemical equation that happens with just the right people in the room. You know, a couple of years ago, I did an album for My Morning Jacket. And those guys are they're great, great people, great, great players. But there's something special that happens when they're in the right place together. It's one two takes, done, wow. Next song.
Wow.
It's just they've got that magic, you know.
Really quick, because we're going to be taking a break, but I have to ask you, what was his vocal chain? What mic did he use?
You know, it's funny. We did a lot of different things for different songs. With Jack, you could never get enough distortion on his voice for him. It was kind of like, make me sound like Little Richard. You know, you know the way those distorted make me sound like that. You know, so it was, we tried. V-72s, 1073s, everything. Most of it in the end, we ended up with, on the control room side of things, like a 1073 into an 1176. But what I ended up doing is working up this crazy scheme out in the studio where basically he sang into two microphones. The 47 or the SM7, whatever was the main microphone, but I strapped a 57 to it. The 57 then went into a guitar amp that was sitting on the floor right in front of him, facing up into the back of the mic. And it was a guitar amp, like a really terrible, you know, the Red Knob era Fender Twins that have a basically a preamp overdrive. So basically, I could get a lot of distortion on the guitar amp, but then I could control the amount of actual master volume on the amp into the room. So not only was it inspiring for him because there was a lot of sound pressure in the room of his voice, mm-hmm. so he kind of even felt his voice in the room like he would on stage through a PA system.
Right.
But all that distorted vocal then came back into the vocal microphone, huh. And then the vocal is being compressed really hard. So obviously it's picking up that distorted vocal and blending it in as part of the sound. And the fact that it's, you know, close by the vocal, there's not a lot of time delay. If anything, it's a few milliseconds, so it almost fattens the voice up,
right,
the time
right.
delay. So it was this crazy scheme that out of desperation, I cooked it up because I couldn't get the preamp to distort it anymore to keep him happy. So I was like, damn, where are we going to get more distortion? I got it.
That is genius. That is genius, Joe.
Did you record the distorted mic separately, or this was just a
single
chain?
All mixed in. One microphone, all mixed in.
Oh, man. I can't wait till the drive home today because I'm going to be listening to that album funny. All the way through. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to continue to visit with Joe, and then we're going to talk a little bit about compression on the backside. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about compression on the backside.
Okay, we were about to.
I just got reamed for saying that beforehand. So we're going to talk about compression
He's
later.
He's got a smile on his face, you know.
At the end of the podcast, if we get to it. Okay. No, but before the break, we were talking with Joe, and he was telling us a little bit about the record with the White Stripes' Icky Thump. And he actually, during the break, he started a story, and I actually cut him off because it was so good, and I wanted to bring you guys in on it. So let us continue a little bit about the story that you were telling us. So give us a little bit of background, Joe.
Well, the interesting part of the record for me, I mean, there's a lot of interesting parts, but the tricky part was the first day that we got started at Blackbird getting sounds. You know, going into it, I thought, okay, here's my chance to do something really kind of old school, simple, honest, natural, you know, good sounding old 67s and 47s, which the studio has tons of, you know, Coles on the guitar amps, few microphones, you know, they've got their sound together. They have a sound as a band. I just have to capture this, you know, and spent, I don't know, an hour or whatever it was getting sounds, and then just sat back for a second and listened to it and was like, oh my God, this is so boring. This sounds like somebody desperately trying to do some retro 1970s thing, and it's got no punch and aggression and impact that a modern record has. How can I get that and combine it with some of the kind of old school aesthetic? And so I just realized that with two instruments, you know, modern records, we talked a lot about that overproduction thing, but right. One thing that does happen is all the space gets filled up. So now I've only got two instruments, and I got to fill all that space that normally gets done with 100 tracks.
Right.
I got to make that equal that with two instruments, basically. So it was a matter of like more microphones, more compression, more subharmonic generator, more of everything to kind of up the whole thing. Make it still sound honest and not like processed tones, but
right.
Trick you into believing that it was equal in terms of bigness and punch and low end impact that a rap record would have.
Right.
And so it was like, man, I just had to close that old school door fast and go down on new tech.
That is so interesting that you say that, because that's one of the things that appeals to me about that record is, even though it's, you know, two instruments, it sounds big. I mean, that growl, that guitar at the beginning, I mean, that's just a great tone. That's a really good tone. It's interesting that, you know, going for that vintage sound, you actually have to, you know, think a little bit bigger.
I really had to scramble fast in the first 2 hours of the session and just totally take a whole new approach to it. Because I really, you know, going into any project, I really think about, okay, where am I going to go with this? What's the picture? Like I said earlier, I'm always, as I go, I'm mixing. You know, I'm thinking about the final mix when I'm overdubbing a tambourine, whether it's printing the reverb or getting the right tambourine sound. I'm thinking about the finish line. Mm-hmm. And so I had to throw out everything fast.
Hey, let's
and look like I knew what I was doing.
Well, let me just tell you, you know, mission accomplished, because really is it's a great record. But let's go back, and I just want to fill us in on how you got started and back, because Joe worked, you know, with Frank Zappa, and wasn't that one of your first acts that you worked with?
I've kind of told a lot of these Frank Zappa stories before, about so I'll kind of be compact with it. But I was a 20-year-old assistant at Cherokee Studios in L.A. when I first moved out here. And this is late 70s, 79, something like that. And, you know, because I was the new kid at the studio, they would always put whatever client was the difficult client, you know, the guy that worked crazy hours, the guy that partied a lot or whatever it was. I always got those troublesome clients. And one day Frank booked into the studio and, you know, everybody was like, no, man, I heard he works crazy hours and, you know, I don't want to work on that. Put Ciccarelli on it. So I was like, okay, fine. And the first day he came into the studio, his engineer got stuck in London with a visa problem, and I ended up engineering for him for like 3 days. He and I just hit it off, got along fine. It was just he and I doing lead vocals and guitar solos, and you know, it's pretty crazy because it was all this like, and this was Shake Your Booty was the album, and so it's all those crazy songs like, you know, Broken Hearts Are for Assholes, and you know, Frank, what'd you think of the vocal? You're a little flat on asshole, Frank. So at the end of the 3 days, he said, look, I got to finish this album, and you know, there's no more time here. They're all booked up. You want to come with me and finish the album? So of course, like, yeah. And the next thing I knew, I was engineering like 6 different albums for him over the course of a number of years. So I kind of got my start as an engineer that way.
Wow.
Yeah, yes. No, it was just an amazingly lucky break. Yeah, it really was.
With the Rob Brothers, huh?
Yeah, with the Rob Brothers, the crazy Rob Brothers, who were great. I mean, I learned so much from D. Rob, from all of them, but I assisted for D a lot. And he was a great engineer, man. He was really, really good. You know, all three brothers were in a band that was a successful 60s band. They had a couple of hit albums out. And So they kind of had a lot of experience in all different sides of the business. But I learned so much about recording. You know, I was at the studio, I had a little experience on my own, and maybe it was a little cocky, but then all of a sudden, you know, I kind of got in the big league with all these just great players, and I just was stunned, you know, mm-hmm. that it was a whole other level, you know, working, you know, the first session I was on as an assistant, Jerry Wexler was producing, and it was, you know, Jeff Beccaro playing drums,
wow.
and Chuck Rainey and Larry Carlton
wow.
you know, Cornell Dupree and all the right. Richard T, you know, Alan Toussaint was the artist. The next album I did was Etta James is the artist. And, you know, it's an incredible education. And it's one thing I always kind of feel bad about all the new generation coming up through recording school or home recording, that you don't have that ability to work with 300 different musicians, 40 different producers, 40 different engineers who all have very different takes on things. And if you're smart enough to sit back and kind of observe it all and not necessarily ask questions, but just kind of take it in and start to figure out why they do things a certain way,
right.
man, you can learn a lot, you know. I worked with Roy Thomas Baker on a number of Journey albums and a lot of things. And I learned so much from Roy. Roy, I actually liked, for me, I liked all the British guys. Cherokee was an all Trident console studio.
Right.
They had three studios with all Tridents. So they got all the UK producers and engineers coming through there. And I really enjoyed the whole British aesthetic because it was they didn't give a shit, you know. They just pushed the limits of everything. You know, nothing was sacred. And I always kind of felt the L.A. thing was very high fidelity. You know, we're talking about early 80s, so right, it's the Steely Dan years.
Yes, exactly.
Everybody's trying to make perfect, pristine records. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a different approach. But, you know, the British guys would come through and, you know, they'd chain up three compressors together or, you know, four EQs and three compressors. And you know, just didn't care, didn't phase them. And at the end of the day, you'd hear it and you go, wow, that's an impressive drum sound or guitar sound. And you just kind of, you know, the day before you were working with somebody that used half the amount of microphones, didn't plug in an EQ or a compressor.
Right.
And, you know, all of a sudden these crazy guys come in and they're doing just the opposite and coming up with amazing results in a whole different light, you know?
Right.
So it was a great education.
So once you kind of got your foot in the door and you started going, were you mainly a mixer? When did you start? How did that producing
come about? Producing thing, I mean, I think just comes about naturally. It's something you always do as part of a session, whether, you know, you're in the background nudging the producer going, I'm going to do another take or, you know, whatever it is, you know, it's just kind of part of the process. And obviously now with budgets, the way it is, the engineer and producer are all wrapped up in one. It just kind of came naturally. I was very, very, very fortunate in that I had produced some demos for a friend that had moved out here from Boston. And these demos ended up in the hands of David Anderle, who was the head of A&R of A&M Records at the time. And he heard them, loved them, and signed the artist up and went, you know what? These demos are so great. Joe, you produce these records. You're going to go in and produce an album for him. Mm. And you know what? I like these so much. I want you to do this band for me. This band's called Oingo Boingo. I want you to do this band for me. So all of a sudden, I had a production career. And I was just like, fine, okay, sure.
If I must.
Then it just kind of, I mean, honestly, I was just fortunate. It just kind of happened. You know, one thing led to another. Of course, you know, you're working hard.
Right.
You have to be ready when you get the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how was it working with Oingo Boingo? How was that?
It was great. It was great. The most difficult thing is that there's like nine guys in the band.
Right.
So there's nine opinions going every time. Sure, I'll take that guitar off. Oh, no, I'll add that guitar back. And sure.
I'll make it louder and softer.
Totally that. Yeah. but it was great. Yeah, it was great. And Danny was always fantastic. And my favorite part of Danny was, you know, dealing with the politics of the band. He had his hands full, and he would sometimes put his head down on the console and sulk and say, if I could ever just do one thing in my life, I want to compose music for films. You know? So
someday he may do that.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Now, when you were working with them, did you know that it was like – because their sound was – you know, kind of came out of left field. I mean, it was like, wow, what is this, you know, mm-hmm. Oingo Boingo thing? I mean, did you know that it was going to be as unique as it was? I mean, how?
I mean, I had seen them live, and it's something I do with every band that I'm about to produce is check it out live. So I kind of know what they're all about. And so I kind of had a sense of what their madness was, you know. Yeah, and it was easy to capture in the sense that they knew how to make a lot of sound. That between the horn section, percussion section, they could make a lot of noise.
Now, what's your method nowadays when you're going to be working with an artist? How do you start? Where do you start? What do you do? What's the Joe Ciccarelli way?
Well, you know, the thing is that there isn't a way. Right. You know, I mean, I'm fumbling through it at every project, and I'm fumbling in different ways through every project. You know, like I mentioned the Jason Mraz thing, and Jason Mraz was an album that we did with no pre-production, just getting in the studio, great musicians, working the arrangements out every day, a new song. Just working it out till we got it. Most bands, I'll go in, spend 2-3 weeks pre-production hammering out parts, tempos, keys, et cetera, et cetera. So it's different. You know, some projects really require a lot of work on the arrangements outside the studio. Others, man, the band has their sound so together that it's just a matter of like thinking like, okay, guitar player's a little weak. I got to help him with his tone. I got to help him with his parts. But the other guys, I just got to be a cheerleader for them because they got their thing together, you know. Just make sure I know when the good performances are there, know when to stop. But, you know, always edging the guitar player along and, you know, paying extra attention to him. So every project is just so different.
And that's probably one of the appeals of working on all the different styles that you work.
Honestly, that's what keeps me sane. Seriously, that every project is different. That I just never know what's going to happen. And every time you think, like the White Stripes story I was telling you about.
Right.
Every time you think you got it figured out, you don't. You're so wrong.
How much of an edge does being such a good engineer help you when you go into producing mode? Because I've met some producers that aren't good engineers that actually have, you know, have their guys that they work with. But you, man, you work with Joe. You kind of, it's a one-stop shop.
And I don't, you know what? But the weird thing is that it's not easy for me. I don't think I'm good at it. I hear other people's records. I'm really serious. I'm not trying to be humble or anything. I mean, I'm being honest.
Well, then I might suck. I'll just be honest.
No, but I mean, it's a struggle for me every day to put faders up and go, oh my God, what a pile of junk this is. Oh, what am I going to do? You know, this sounds terrible. And, you know, I really have to scramble. I have to run out in the room 15 times and move microphones or change microphones or, you know, whatever it is. It's a guessing game for me every single time I walk behind that console. It's and when you think you got it figured out, you do not.
Wow. Well, Joe, on behalf of the world, you don't suck. And you are good.
It's like group therapy. Thank you, guys.
I'm just saying. Well, great. You know, that's awesome hearing some of these stories. Let me ask you a couple really quick questions. What's one of your favorite vocal microphones?
Wow. Boy, you know, see, again, you know, talking about really not having a method. You know, when a singer comes in the room, I'll put up a dozen microphones and try them all and find the one that kind of captures their personality. And sometimes it's a cheap microphone. Sometimes it's a 57. Sometimes it's a 47. Sometimes it's whatever. And often there's maybe two or three.
Right.
And you go, oh, well, this one kind of works for the ballad, or this one is better when they're in their upper range because it doesn't squawk as much. So I don't know. I mean, it really depends. I mean, I use C12s, I use 251s, I use SM7s, I use C37s, I use anything with a 7 in it.
No, but you know what? That's a really great and actually encouraging answer, because sometimes people get caught up in the whole, you know, this microphone's the best and this one and that one. It's just like, and you know, you got to listen. You got to listen for...
They all have their own personality. Yeah. It's like a guitar or a keyboard or anything. They all have a different vibe.
Well, know? And the mics you just rattled off, there was a massive swing in price too. From hundreds
to
90,000.
From hundreds to
90,000.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question. What's one of your favorite pieces of outboard gear?
Well,
and coffee maker doesn't count.
That's right.
I'm kicking it. I'm down a cup today. Yeah. You know, I'm really impressive. I'm trying hard impressive. to back down to the coffee. But you know, the standard stuff gets used all the time. The 1176s, the LA2As, the 3As, the distressors. I guess the newer stuff that's come out in the last 5-10 years. I'm addicted to all the Chandler stuff. I think he makes great sounding stuff with a lot of personality. You know, the smart stuff, the Neve compressors get used all the time. What else am I using a lot lately? The new Electrodyne EQs sound really good. It's also different for stuff that I do musically. If I'm doing a lot of rock stuff, I want stuff with color and personality and aggression and definitely, you know, the API stuff. I'm using it all the time, and I almost forget about it because it's like part of my body now. I'm mostly at Sunset Sound, right, which is a custom built console, but it's all API EQs. So that gets used on everything. The API 2500 compressor. It's funny. It's a compressor that when I first got it, I was like, whoa, this thing is so aggressive. I can't use it on too many things. But now that I've had it for a while, I start using it on more and more things and start finding that it's just a super versatile piece of equipment. Best piano compressor ever made. And on the right program material, best stereo bus compressor ever made. So that stuff is kind of like just a daily go-to. And again, especially for rock and roll, if I'm doing something that's maybe a little poppier, you know, I might use some preamp, a Millennia, or something that's a little bit more invisible and doesn't have as much color.
When you played with plugins much?
All the time.
And how is it like UAD stuff compared to some of the, you know,
the UAD stuff is, you know, it's funny, that's the stuff that's now like my daily go-to, you know, that ever since they came out with that Satellite, I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah, got one.
I dragged that around to every studio.
Yeah,
because their emulations, their models, you know, not putting all of them side by side, but I gotta say, overall their stuff sounds really, really good. The one thing that I found was great about the Satellite box, because there's so many different effects in there, when, you know, space echoes, dimension Ds, and all that stuff, is that I could do this thing where I could take a vocal or a guitar or whatever, and I could bus it to 10 different effects, and then just pick and choose. Go, I like this for this section here. Ooh, I like this for the bridge. Okay, cool. You know, the vocals, you know, like most stuff nowadays, there's always some delays going on vocals. Even if they're hidden in the back of the track that you don't hear them, they're there to kind of enhance the vocal. So I kind of go, I like the tape delay for the verses. And, I like the harder digital plug-in for the choruses where you really hear it. Or I like a little bass echo right behind his voice to give it a little dimension, and you know, so that stuff's good. But I do think the quality of their emulations, pretty impressive.
Wow. Hey, listen, we're going to be running a little long, so I don't know if we're going to be able to talk about compression. We're going to have to save that for another podcast because I'm just enjoying listening to Joe.
Oh, man, I'm sorry, I'm hogging the floor.
No, no, believe me. Believe me. But what I do want to ask you is I want to ask you about compression and how you feel about compression and bus compression. I mean, do you hit it hard? Or do you tap it light? I mean, what's your philosophy on
stereo bus compression?
Stereo bus compression, any just compression in general.
You know, it just depends on what I'm going for. Again, the stereo bus thing. If it hits more than three or four, then I get really nervous and back it off. But normally, it's just one, two at the most. And I'll change the compressor from song to song, certainly from project to project. Sometimes it's something really, very, benign, like a inwards connection, you know, tube compressor, or a lot of times it's the smart. I don't have a problem compressing. You know, there's this thing that, I don't know, people started 10 years ago. You can't compress electric guitars because they're already compressed. It's like,
yeah,
okay.
Who wrote that rule?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, I'm more interested in how hot I hit Pro Tools or how hot I don't hit Pro Tools. So I can hear the compression. I know when it doesn't sound right to me. So I don't even look at the meters on compressor. I need output meters. I never need gain reduction meters.
Right.
You know, it's like, I don't care what they read. I'll just, what sounds good, that's it. Fine.
So what about any particular type of vocal compression that you like when you're working? When you do your vocals, do you smack it or do you just kind of just maintain it and then wait for the mix to really kind of whip it in?
It's just what sound is right. Every singer is different. Some singers, it's 1 TdB. Other people, it's 10. I've been really into my Retro 176 lately because with that thing, the tone of it is so beautiful. And you can compress things a lot and not know that you're compressing it. In fact, I was doing a muted trumpet the other day and normally I might put like a LA-2A or something just to smooth it out from time to time because muted trumpets can be kind of nasty with peaks.
Right.
And just the Retro is there and I went, okay, I'll try this. And things sounded awesome. And, you know, one of those deals where everything's going great, takes rolling along, players sounding great, everything's good. And I look over the compressor and it's like, fine.
Hey, sounds
great.
Whatever sounds good.
You know, yeah, I mean, I didn't notice it at all. Who cares about that stuff?
No one cares how it looks.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is so awesome to hear, too, because sometimes you get people who would get that exact same sound, look at the compressor, look at whatever piece of gear, see what it's doing, and say, oh, I can't have it do that, and then change it, you know?
So I have a question about your vocal chain and stuff, because this is a – everybody goes back and forth on this one, but like if you're doing a vocal, do you usually have the EQ before the compressor or after?
I knew this was coming. You know, I go back and forth with that. It depends on the singer. If I want it a little bit more open and hi-fi, I'll do it after. If I want it a little punchier and to grab more, I'll do it in front. But more often than not, I'll EQ before the compressor than after the compressor. The reason being is that I find it's a little bit more aggressive that way. Mm. You have to watch things a bit more. You have to police yourself, especially with low end. But I can kind of get a little bit more power and even character out of things. Certainly, you know, your top end can go away, especially with a lot of old school compressors. So you got to watch it, but I would say probably 60% of the time it's in front.
Have you done one before and one after?
Yeah, actually, yeah. Yeah. A lot of times I'll do something where, yeah, maybe. In fact, who did I do just recently do that for? The Jason Mraz stuff. You know, it was a Pultec in front, and then an API EQ for the air on after the compressor.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Great. Well, hey, listen, we got to wrap it up. But
no,
Joe,
no, say
this
so.
Has been awesome, Joe. Thank you so much.
Well, this is part A.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
You know what? But promise me it's not going to be another 6 years before you come back?
You got to have them like in the morning or at midnight or Saturday. Not, this is prime vocal hour. I should be right in the middle of a vocal take.
That's right. We're damaging his career by pulling him away.
Okay, it's 9:25 p.m. It's not like we do this at 2 o'clock in like a Thursday. Well, hey, thank you so much. And a round of applause for
you. Yeah. Yeah. Round of applause for you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That was awesome. And I learned a ton. And I just, you know, I keep learning all kinds of stuff with these guys that are coming
what
in.
What are you
this
doing? Just to
hire.
This
pretty badass for you. You get all these guys coming in, spilling all their,
that's
their,
right.
their secrets.
That's
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think what we learned today is just hire Joe.
Hey, but before we go, does anybody working on anything they can talk about? Anybody working on anything interesting?
I'll just say Scott and I have been working on some projects together. I've been doing a bunch of music stuff with him, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yay.
You know, I just actually, I'll throw something out that I had a unique experience, which may not sound unique to most people, but for me it is. But I ended up mixing a movie from cradle to grave, designed it, created it. It's very dialogue and music based. Just me and the director, and which in my business is rare because usually there's a whole backfield of music editors and picture editors and sometimes you end up mixing and creating by committee. And this was great where I was just coming in every day, talking, grab some coffee, very relaxed, and just, okay, let's go for the next reel. Let's go for it. The person who recorded his dialogue was pretty challenged. I'll just say it that way. I had some very challenging tracks. And you know, I first started, I just said, oh, my God, how am I going to deal with this? Because, because it was a low-budget indie, the rooms were not great. I mean, they were reverberant, and they were doing everything by boom. So if there were wide shots and medium shots, you got the room. There were close-ups, you got it tight. So every handful of lines, I had very different landscapes of reverb and trying to match and fill and noise floors and distortion. So it was very challenging, but it was quite fun and it was just a wonderful experience. The movie's called Any Day Now.
Oh, great.
And it'd be coming probably to a theater near you, I think.
We'll have to check it out.
Yeah, so he's just selling it and we just got finished and it's just quite a wonderful film.
Cool.
Very touching.
Cool.
It is great though, you know, when there is a singular vision involved in a project and it is not by committee.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
As most pop records are now.
Sure.
There's an A&R person, there's a head of A&R, there's a label president that comes in, there's the manager, there's everybody else, you know, in the team involved. And there are so many opinions that things do get watered down. And I mean, you guys deal with that all the time. I have a number of friends in advertising, and I don't know how the hell they do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's called mixing by committee. Joe, are you working on anything?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of this new Alanis Morissette record.
Oh, great!
Oh, nice.
Pretty wonderful. Yeah, she's very special. She's a super unique artist, a sweetheart to deal with. Just the most positive person in the world. A great singer. Just basically walks in and it's two takes and done. And, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, I guess the first one's good. Well, second one's good too. I don't know which one. it's that difficult.
Wow.
You know, so that's been pretty fun.
Great. That's pretty awesome.
How about you, Mike?
Let's see. Right now I'm, Martin Page is going to be coming out with a new album. So I'm working on some stuff for him, some video stuff. And actually, this week I'll be interviewing Joe for API. I've been doing some interviews for API. Just did Jack Douglas and Warren Hewitt. They're working on the Aerosmith album, and we just filmed them over at Swing House. And we're going to be talking with Joe over at Sunset. And so Cool. If you want to see Joe again,
exactly,
you'll be able to go to the API website and see our interview that we're going to do.
I look much better on video than actually in person. Hair and makeup.
But yeah, so that's what I've been up to. All right. Well, hey, if you have any questions or comments, you can reach us at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/audionowcast. Or you can send us an email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And we'll try to answer them eventually.
No, we're pretty good about that.
We are. One thing, though, is we're going to have to do a podcast because last time when we were talking with Dave, we were talking about background vocals, and Steve Currington from the Facebook page wanted us to discuss a cappella vocals. Mm. So we're going to have to talk about that somewhere down the road.
Barbershop,
huh? But I just remembered that. But I wanted to do a shout out to Steve because he's a really good listener and he's pretty active.
All right, Steve.
And you have to remind us to talk about these things, Steve, before the last 8 seconds.
Yeah,
of
I know.
The show.
I know.
That'd be helpful.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that when Joe's not here. Who's probably the most qualified?
Right.
Anyhow, well, hey, just wanted to thank everybody for listening, and from myself, and thank you, Joe, for showing up.
You're
thank
welcome,
you, Joe.
For myself and the rest of the guys, take care, and we'll catch you next time.
To the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.